It's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use, and Uncle Dennis suggests that you have a pencil and paper handy because you never know when something might be said that you want to write down, remember later, act on, or generally get riled up about, and, you know, might be nice to have a clue as to what it was. So, anyway, here it goes. The 2014 Earth First Organizers Conference is underway in Florida. You'll definitely want to be in Lake Worth about now and get yourself on out to the 2014 Earth First Organizers Conference and Winter Rendezvous. It goes through until Monday, so anyway, you ought to be there by now. If you don't, if you want more information about how to get there, and especially if you're close to Florida and could drive there in a day or two, www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net/EFOC2014. That's www.EvergladesEarthFirst.net/EFOC2014. Celeste, you're going to hear about that until we have news about what they do after the rendezvous. Coming up on Friday, March 7th, Greg King, writer, photographer, executive director of the Siskiyou Land Conservancy, and probably the guy most responsible for saving the Headwaters Forest, is going to be speaking at the Department of Environmental Studies on Friday, March 7th from noon to 1:15 p.m. in the Bacardo Business Complex 004. I presume that's a room of some kind at San Jose State University. His talk is going to be entitled The Ghost Forest, A Personal History of the Ancient Redwood Ecosystems and Struggles to Protect It. And I'm not going to go on much, just that he had discovered Pacific Lumber's new parent company, Maxam, and Redwood Summer and everything else ensued. All are welcome. Light refreshments are provided. Once again, Greg King speaking at San Jose State University, Friday, March 7th, from noon to 1:15 p.m. in Bacardo Business Complex 004. The Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. On Wednesday morning, as Buffalo Field Campaign gardener patrols were monitoring the buffalo held captive inside Yellowstone's Stevens Creek Trap, stock trailers arrived. 17 buffalo were loaded on and transported 300 miles by the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes to a tribal slaughter facility in Ronan, Montana. Hard times are underway for wild buffalo as hunting, capture, and slaughter increases. Since early February, approximately 87 wild buffalo have been trapped within Yellowstone National Park in the Stevens Creek Capture Facility in the Gardner Basin. None of the buffalo had ever left the park. Park rangers are not actively hazing buffalo into the trap, and patrols in Gardner are convinced that the Park Service has been baiting them with hay, a tactic the Montana Department of Livestock is known to use. Of the buffalo that have been captured to date, 37 were shipped by the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes to their slaughter facility, and along with the 17 that went yesterday, 5 buffalo were taken by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service to be used in experiments like the birth control chemical gonacon. The buffalo that are still in the trap at the time of this writing will likely be taken to other tribal slaughter facilities by the Intertribal Buffalo Council, a federally chartered buffalo ranching organization, and this could happen as early as tomorrow. We also learned the Nez Perce tribe has just signed a slaughter agreement with Yellowstone, so they too will begin to transport wild buffalo from the Stevens Creek trap to Nez Perce slaughter facilities in Idaho, more than a 12-hour drive away. While tribal governments are making these drastic decisions to fully participate in slaughtering wild buffalo, there are many within these tribes who strongly oppose such actions, and these voices will not go unheard. While these terrible actions are taking place, hunting has also been staining the landscape red. 167 buffalo so far have been killed by state and treaty hunters. Within the Gardner Basin, where buffalo are being trapped, state and treaty hunters have killed 75 buffalo since capture operations began. The state hunt finally ended on February 15th, but native treaty hunting will continue into April, with the calving season just around the corner. In the Hebgen Basin, west of Yellowstone's boundary, a family group that we had come to know very well has been shattered. These 26 buffalo had been keeping themselves alive by residing on the Galanas property and in Yellowstone Village, both buffalo-friendly residential areas on Horse Butte where hunting is not allowed. Day after day, we would breathe a sigh of relief because the buffalo seemed to be quite content staying in this safe zone. But these buffalo-friendly properties are adjacent to the Gallatin National Forest where hunting is permitted. There were times when the group of 26 would move over to the National Forest land, giving us a good scare, but they always moved there when there were no hunters around, and when hunters did arrive, they found the buffalo safely back in no hunting areas. We can't be sure, but we strongly suspect that some hunters got frustrated with the buffalo being inaccessible. Late last week, patrols discovered the buffalo gone and trespassing snowmobile tracks on the Galanas property. The tracks circled and circled, which lead us to believe that the buffalo were harassed and pushed out of their safe zone. In the days following this discovery, the group split up and 8 of them were shot by state hunters. 6 of these buffalo were shot near the Madison River in a sensitive riparian area of the Gallatin National Forest that is closed to snowmobiles. As if it weren't already far too easy to kill buffalo, the hunters asked for permission to take their snowmobiles down into this closed area to retrieve their kills. They were unfortunately granted permission by Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Only a small handful of these buffalo remain in the area, and they are currently back on the Galanas property and safe for now. For further information, go to the Buffalo Field Campaign's webpage at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. If you want to send anything to the Buffalo Field Campaign, send it to P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. If you have any questions, give them a call at 406-646-0070, 406-646-0070. And coming up tomorrow afternoon, Michael Mies of the Buffalo Field Campaign will be interviewed on Resistance Radio, and that will be played here on Free Radio Santa Cruz starting at 6 o'clock, I believe. No, that starts at 6:30 tomorrow night. You can hear Mike Mies on the radio. Do remember the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. Legal action aims to stop shrimp fisheries mass killing of sea turtles. More than 53,000 threatened and endangered sea turtles drown in shrimp trawl nets every year in the southeastern U.S. Yet the National Marine Fisheries Service still hasn't conducted a full analysis of how the region's fishery is affecting sea turtles in the southeast and the Gulf of Mexico, a crucial step to protect wildlife like Green and Kemp's Ridley sea turtles from this deadly industry. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have notified the agency that we plan to sue over its failure. Our action comes just 2 years after conservation groups settled another lawsuit aimed to address the 3,500-plus sea turtles stranded dead or injured in the same area in 2011. Many of these deaths were likely linked to the shrimp industry. Fishery Service promised to pursue a new rule to help sea turtles, but later backed away. The agency has gotten into a disturbing habit of initiating protections and then stalling them, said Center's Jackie Lopez. But every day protections are delayed is another day that these sea turtles face the real risk of drowning in shrimp nets. And Idaho plans to wipe out 60% of the wolves in the Frank Church Wilderness. Just weeks after a state-hired hunter and trapper killed 9 wolves in central Idaho's Frank Church River No Return Wilderness, and officials pulled him out, the state's Department of Fish and Game released a plan calling for more intensive wolf killing in the same location, the largest forested wilderness area in the lower 48 states. The plan to kill 60% of wolves in the wilderness area is intended to please hunters by boosting the local elk population beyond the level natural predator-prey interactions would support. Last month, the Center and allies filed an emergency motion asking the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to preserve the wolves, and soon after, Idaho Fish and Game temporarily halted the program. More than 900 Idaho wolves have already been killed during state-sanctioned hunting and trapping seasons. The senseless slaughter will continue unless the courts step in and stop it. And a lawsuit has been launched to protect wildlife people from Hudson River oil spills. Shipments of highly explosive crude oil through Albany, New York, and along the Hudson River are rapidly expanding with the domestic oil and gas fracking boom. Unfortunately, the government's antiquated plans for dealing with the resulting oil spills fail to protect endangered species and human communities from the billions of gallons of oil now funneling through the region. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed a formal notice of intent to sue the U.S. Coast Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency for failing to update those plans, in addition to carrying fracked North Dakota Bakken crude, which has been a culprit in numerous train derailment accidents and fatalities over the past year, including one in Quebec, killing 47 people and destroying a town. Trains and ships in the Hudson River corridor may soon be transporting Alberta tar sands oil. That would be particularly risky for the Hudson's aquatic life, since tar sands spilled in water sink to the bottom and are extremely expensive and difficult to remove. At least 17 federally protected endangered species, including Atlantic sturgeon, sea turtles, and piping plovers, are threatened by the increased risk of spills. The Hudson River is the lifeblood of New York, its past, its future, its identity, said Molly Madison, a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity. It's also a natural disaster. It's a major oil spill here would be a disaster for wildlife and people alike. And you can find more information at www.biologicaldiversity.org. A major marbled murrelet victory and 28 canceled timber sales. Yeehaw! Three conservation organizations secured a major victory for Oregon's coastal forests, reaching a settlement agreement with the state that cancels 28 timber sales in habitat for the threatened marbled murrelet in Elliott, Clatsop, and Tillamook State Forests, and approves future management practices to ensure the rare seabird is not harmed. This agreement provides immediate relief for the dwindling population of the marbled murrelet, said Francis Etherington, conservation director of Cascadia Wildlands. The state of Oregon needs to see more in our state forests than timber volume. The agreement settles a legal challenge brought by the conservation organizations in 2012, arguing that logging of state forests authorized by the Oregon Department of Forestry harms the seabird, which is protected as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. Marbled murrelets are unique among songbirds in that they nest on the wide branches of large old trees, making a daily trip of up to 35 miles inland to bring fish to their young. Logging of their forest homes is the primary threat to their survival. This is a huge win for marbled murrelets and other species that depend on older forests, said Rob Salinger, conservation director of the Audubon Society in Portland. The number of canceled sales speaks to how out of alignment the state's practices were with the law. Hopefully, this marks the beginning of a new era of responsible and sustainable management of our state's forests. If you're going to save the marbled murrelet, we have to protect the old forest this unique seabird calls home, said Noah Greenwald, endangered species director for the Center for Biological Diversity. The state of Oregon and ODF flouted the law for years and are now paying the price. It's time for the state to find a path forward that generates income for schools, but doesn't drive species extinct in the process. Oregon Department of Forestry previously had a habitat conservation plan for the Elliott State Forest that allowed it to log some older forest habitat in exchange for protecting other areas critical for threatened and endangered species in the long term, and was working on a plan for the Tillamook and Clatsop State Forests. ODF then abandoned its plans in order to log areas it had previously promised to protect. This broken promise left the state vulnerable to the litigation filed by the groups in May of 2012. Under the settlement agreement, the state will now have to protect more habitat for murrelets on state forests. This habitat is key to protecting the species, as current research in the Pacific Northwest shows that marbled murrelet populations are declining by approximately 4% per year. Clearcutting of older forest on the three coastal state forests was a contributing factor. The Elliott State Forest is a 93,000-acre forest located in the Coast Range east of Coos Bay. The Clatsop and Tillamook are made up of over 500,000 acres in the Northwest Oregon Coast Range. In addition to providing habitat for imperiled species, these forests have a mandate to generate revenue for county and state services. Rather than clear-cut older trees in the three forests to help fund schools and roads, the conservation organizations have long encouraged the state to pursue beneficial opportunities. They recommend protection of the forest for use as carbon markets, a timber program that focuses on restoration thinning of dense plantation forests, and the sale of key habitat to land trusts or other conservation interests, or a combination of these mechanisms. For further information, visit the website www.cascwild.org. That's cascwild.org. And San Francisco man has been cited for shark fin possession. Wildlife officers from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife recently cited a San Francisco man for possession of shark fins for sale. On January 29th, wildlife officers conducted a fish business inspection on Kwong Yip Incorporated in San Francisco and found what appeared to be shark fins for sale on the premises. It is unlawful to possess shark fins for sale in California. They cited the owner, Michael Kwong, age 42, of San Francisco, for the violation. As part of the investigation, wildlife officers seized 2,138 pounds of product believed to be shark fin, and ongoing analysis verified that all of the seized product was shark fin. Fish and Game Code 2021, the law that prohibits possession of shark fin for sale, went into effect in 2011, but included a phase-in period to allow restaurants and other businesses to sell off their remaining stock. But as of July 1st, 2013, no person may possess any shark fins for sale in California. For further information, go to www.dfg.ca.gov. And Lake County deer poachers are convicted and sentenced. Five poachers were recently convicted and sentenced in Lake County for illegally spotlighting and killing deer, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Lake County District Attorney's Office announced. On August 24, 2013, Lake County wildlife officers conducted a night patrol targeting those who use bright lights to shine at and then kill deer at night, an illegal activity commonly called spotlighting. Warden pilots from CDFW's Air Services assisted in providing overhead surveillance. Just after midnight, the warden pilots noticed spotlighting near Lucerne, California. Using night vision, they observed occupants of a vehicle shoot and kill two animals. The men walked up to the dead animals and then turned around, walked back to their vehicle, and drove away, leaving the carcasses to waste. The men continued using the spotlight as they drove around that night. Wildlife officers on the ground responded and detained five occupants in the suspect vehicle. They found multiple firearms and a spotlight plugged into the cigarette lighter. When they returned to the site where the warden pilot saw the shooting, they found two freshly killed does. Lake County Chief Deputy District Attorney Richard Hinchcliffe, who supervises the prosecuting of poaching and pollution crimes, filed charges against all five suspects, including conspiracy, spotlighting, wanton waste of game, and other related charges. In court, all five pleaded no contest, were fined $1,155 each, prohibited from hunting for 3 years, and had their firearms seized. One defendant was sentenced to 30 days in jail. Hinchcliffe recognized the effort of Lake County Superior Court Judge Andrew Blum for each of the five cases, plus other local judges who are willing to impose tough sentences on violators. Without the cooperation of local judges, we cannot obtain sentences that significantly punish poachers and deter would-be poachers, said Hinchcliffe. Our local judges continue to demonstrate how much they care about our fish and wildlife resources. Poaching will not be tolerated in Lake County. And for more information, you can go to www.dfg.ca.gov. If you see anything unlawful going on, call California Department of Fish and Wildlife's CalTIP hotline at 888-334-2258. That's 888-334-2258. Let's not tolerate poachers. And poachers in Africa have killed three of Malawi's rare black rhinos in this story from the Environment News Service. Wire snares and traps set by poachers have cost the Malawian Department of National Parks and Wildlife three of the critically endangered black rhinoceroses that were reintroduced 20 years ago after the species was declared extinct in Malawi. The collapse of the electric solar-powered perimeter fence around a 14-square-kilometer sanctuary has created a loophole inside the Liwandi National Park in the Southern District region of Machinga, conservationists said. The lack of a fence, which was not built due to a wider financial scandal in Malawi dubbed Cashgate, allowed poachers to enter the sanctuary. The black rhinos were reintroduced from South Africa's Kruger National Park through the Care for Rare Wildlife Species program, initially supported by J&B Whiskey and several business magnates. Care for the Rare was an idea hatched following Malawi's black rhino extinction after two of the last remaining animals were wiped out by armed poachers in the Mwambwe Wildlife Reserve in 1991. The proliferation of automatic assault rifles from the 16-year civil war in neighboring Mozambique is believed to be the cause of Malawi's last remaining population of rhinoceroses, highly sought globally for their horns. In an obituary statement following the loss of the three rhinos, Bentley Palmer, a lead member of the rhino monitoring team, said the dead female, Justerini, together with the dead male, Brooks, were the original two rhinos brought back into Liwandi as part of Malawi's Black Rhino Reintroduction Program. They arrived at Chileke Airport on October 28th from Kruger National, and that was in 1993, from Kruger National Park. Justerini produced six calves during her 20 good years in Liwandi. However, on July 15th, 2013, rhino monitoring team sighted Justerini in the sanctuary, and when they started to track her, they found she was dragging a massive gin trap on her left rear leg. They lost her tracks, and even after days of searching, she still managed to evade any contact with the monitoring team. Ironically, on October 15th, which is Mother's Day in Malawi, the carcass of this rhino mother was found by a rhino monitoring patrol 2 kilometers from a waterhole inside Liwandi National Park. She died from the results of the gin trap snare, a steel spring trap which severed off her foot. The death was most likely from loss of blood or thirst from her inability to get to water, a slow and very painful death estimated to have occurred around the end of July or early August 2013. The trap and her horns were found intact at her final resting place, said Palmer, a passionate wildlife conservationist, in an obituary to Justerini. Another black rhino named Ultima, a very young, unsexed rhino calf, was found in April 2012 after the rainy season in a decomposed state. A wire snare was found at the carcass on the scene. The horns were missing, as was the meat. In 1998, the second breeding pair of black rhinos named Bentley and Julia was brought to Liwandi from Kruger National Park. Bentley became the dominant male in the sanctuary in 2000 after the natural death of an original bull, and he sired several calves between 2000 and 2012. In September 2012, a monitoring patrol found him strangled in a wire snare around his throat, lying dead in a small stream. He had been dead for only 1 hour, and his horns were recovered before poachers got to him. An ambush was set up, but the poachers did not return to the scene of the crime, Palmer said. When asked for a reaction, Brighton Kumchadwa, Malawi's director of parks and wildlife, confirmed the loss and said it was indeed sad the country was losing rare and endangered species in such a manner after huge monetary investments had been made. We are working around the clock with our partners like the Central Africa Wilderness Safaris and other concerned individuals so we can fight poachers head-on, said Kumchadwa. However, Paul Taylor, who chairs the Wildlife and Environmental Society of Malawi, Balantri branch, told Environment News Service that poaching of wildlife, including rhino, is indicative of the almost complete breakdown of law enforcement in Liwandi National Park, which includes the high-security rhino sanctuary. There is irrefutable evidence of corruption among wildlife personnel in collusion with the local police, Taylor told Environment News Service. The Department of National Parks and Wildlife's failure to erect a perimeter electric fence in Liwandi National Park comes at a time when a major financial scam has rocked the Malawian government. Millions of dollars have been looted through bogus transfers to firms that provided no services. And a new tapir species has been discovered in the Amazon in this story from Environment News Service. A new species of tapir, a mammal considered to be endangered or vulnerable, has been identified by scientists in the Amazon rainforest in parts of Brazil and Colombia. It is the smallest of the 5 known species of living tapirs, the first tapir discovery since 1865, and the first time in 100 years that a new species has been found in the order Persisodactylia, which includes tapirs, rhinos, and horses. An article in the current issue of the journal Mammalogy reports the discovery. Using the largest geographic sample to date of a related species, the authors provide physical and DNA evidence to support their proposal that the tapirs be classified as a new species, Tapirus cobomani. To determine the uniqueness of T. cobomani, the authors examined the skull, some tissue, and DNA samples and made measurements. The skull differs in shape and features from those of all other living tapirs. T. cobomani differs from other tapir species found in its range, having darker hair, a lower mane, and broader forehead than Tapirus terrestris. It weighs about 240 pounds, measures just over 4 feet in length and 3 feet high at the shoulder, and it has shorter limbs than all other living and several extinct tapir species. Genetic studies showed distinct results for T. cobomani. The first known specimen collected for this species of tapir remained unidentified for almost 100 years. The collector was Theodore Roosevelt, who was president of the United States from 1901 to 1909. Roosevelt remarked in 1914 that this specimen was a bull full-grown, but very much smaller than the animal I had killed. The hunters said this was a distinct kind. Roosevelt sent the specimen to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City for analysis, but it was considered just a variation of T. terrestris. Tapirs currently live in Southeast Asia and Central and South America. Historically, these mammals roamed over a wide geographic range, but today's tapir species are isolated from one another and are suffering from overhunting and habitat destruction. And here's some news about biological diversity. Missouri plan is subpar for the amazing hellbender and other species. The Ozark hellbender is going to have a heck of a time if a draft management plan for Missouri's Ozark National Scenic Riverways, recently released by the National Park Service, becomes final. The plan, up for comment, covers a vast, beautiful landscape that's home to rare animals like hellbenders, rare crayfish, and gray bats, and gets more than 1 million human visitors a year. While the new plan does close some undesignated trails that are damaging the local ecosystem, it also authorizes 35 miles of new horse trails with additional river crossings as well as a new horse campground along Jack's Fork, which the Park Service itself admits would increase the likelihood for water quality degradation. The plan is supposed to be revise an outdated 1984 version that has resulted in misuse and water pollution, but will it really do the trick? The hellbender, for one, an amazing ancient 2-foot-long salamander, the largest living in North America, deserves more. And that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday night right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz. It's also rebroadcast every Friday afternoon from 3 to 3:30 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast and you live near Moscow, Idaho, tune in to KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, Monday nights at 9:30 p.m. The Radio Free Moscow can be heard at 90.3 FM, its new high-power frequency. If you would like to download or listen to a podcast of the Earth First Update, you can also go to the website www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number, forall.net. I do want to remind folks that the Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, and we certainly would like to thank you for listening.